Welcome to another podcast from the Chapter House, a gathering place for teaching and other interesting conversations from the Ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. A chapter house is a room or a building attached to a cathedral where meetings are held. In monastic communities, the monks would meet there to read aloud from the Bible or discuss theology. Come on in to the Epiclesis Chapter House. Our next gathering is just about to begin. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome back to another recording, another edition, another conversation of the Chapter House. The Chapter House is a place where we can have, I guess you would say, extended conversations. Our normal Sunday morning teaching and sermons and that kind of thing go on our regular podcast side. But when we have longer conversations, and I think today's going to really need to be one, I love to come to the Chapter House. So welcome. We're glad you're here. My very, very, and I mean that, special guest today is Reverend Steve Pearson. He's my buddy from Canada. And, you know, Steve, first of all, hey and welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Chris. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, let's wait and see when it's over. But Steve, I guess the first thing to do, well, you're going to come to our church, and we are, I can't tell you how excited we are, because we're just so glad. We've been trying to think of a way to get you down here anyway. And so you're coming, and it's going to be a really big deal in the fall. It's a retreat about the Lord of the Rings and the world of Tolkien. But before we get to that, I would just love for you to introduce folks a little bit, tell them a little something about you, and what in the world are you doing in Canada anyway, and that kind of stuff.
Well, first off, thank you again for having me, and I so look forward to the fall and being able to meet you all and to just share some thoughts together and explore some of these topics together. As for myself, I grew up in Nebraska. I am a Cornhusker at heart, and I lived there for 45 years, roughly in the Midwest, and pastored there for 20, 25 years.
Wow.
And then after taking a brief time off from being a pastor, about a year, and I was living in Texas, which is where my wife is from. We were living in Dallas. We did some exploring and looking around and poked at a lot of different possibilities, and a small church up in Canada, in Manitoba, opened up, and so I ended up here. It's a rural church, but a phenomenal group of people that is so deeply interested in being involved in the community, and they reach out to places like the local drug rehab center, and we have a youth drop-in center, a youth group that runs 40 to 50 kids, and which for a very rural area is just amazing, the ministry that God has given these folks as they show his love in the community. And when I say rural, the town I live in is about 8,000 people, Dauphin, Manitoba, but the church is about 20 miles or so east of here. And the nearest town to that church, to the church there, is, I like to say, it's about 300 people if you count the house pets. And it's a really tough town. It's called Oka River, and it really is a lot of challenges in that community, and that's where our youth drop-in center is, and just some amazing opportunities to be involved in families' lives and things that we wouldn't get if we were just staying inside our walls. And then the other town near there is St. Rose, and there's a drug rehabilitation center there, which I serve lunch at once a week, and then we run a bus there and pick folks up for Sunday, and just amazing opportunities to minister there as well. And so a wonderful place. But Chris, I got to tell you, we have gorgeous summers. Like right now, middle of June, we're looking at about 70 degrees, cool breeze. Nice. Just phenomenal.
Nice.
Oh my goodness. But let me tell you about the winters, and I'll keep it short. I'll sum it up with the fact that this last winter, around the time of February, we went for about 1 month where one time it got above zero.
Ouch.
Yeah. It's chilly, if you will.
Well, do you have a house pet at your house, by the way?
We do. Yes, we do. We have one rabbit named Midnight, and it was a rescue rabbit. I should point to the real source of the issue here is my wife. She absolutely loves rabbits. And when we got married, she said, love me, love my rabbit. And so I loved her. And now I take care of said bunny.
Of course you do.
And when Tiffany's away working or something like that, then I step in and take care of that little varmint. But I like the rabbit. So I just got to pick on it once in a while.
So you're in the middle of, well, it sounds pretty rural, to say the least, Canada. How mm-hmm. in the world did you get linked up with us here at Epiclesis? Tell that origin story.
A couple of years ago, well, more than a couple now, maybe 5 years ago.
I think so.
I was doing some reading by Robert Weber, and his book, Journey to Jesus, I believe, mm-hmm. had in there some references to a curriculum that had been written along with the book, or to accompany the book, or the book accompanying the curriculum.
Right.
And I wanted to find that curriculum. Well, it's been out of print for a while, and I did some emailing different places, and finally was connected to you as being the sort of place that I could find that curriculum. Mm-hmm. And while perusing your church's website, I saw a Thursday group that gathered at 10 o'clock Central, 8 o'clock your time in the morning, just for take communion together, to reflect a little bit on scripture and life, and go through a liturgy together and enjoy each other's company. And one of the challenges that I've always had in rural ministry is, how do you nourish your own soul, both intellectually and spiritually, when there is a lot of loneliness, a lot of aloneness, I'll put it that way, and not the sort of loneliness that marriage necessarily is meant to address, because I got married a little bit later when I was 42, but the sort of loneliness of finding others outside your church to mm-hmm. nourish your soul, to nourish your journey. And then intellectually, my, I don't want to say my credentials, but my interests have always been in the direction of philosophy. And started out leaning towards apologetics, then got focused a little more on the specific area of apologetics that was really interested in how do we know what we know, and not necessarily, well, I'll give you evidence, you give me evidence, but fundamentally, what does it mean to know something? And I ended up studying at Le Brie for a semester,
which location?
England.
Yeah, okay.
And just really wrestling with this problem of how can we know anything, because you get into thinking through issues, and different people have different perspectives, and everybody offers their evidence, and they argue and yell. And at the end of the day, there's no way to stand outside of that and be totally objective. So how do you claim to know anything? And so I studied there for a while, and I've always been interested in philosophy. God brought me back to pastoring quite often. I was in the doctorate program at the University of Nebraska, and for a number of reasons, didn't continue to pursue that. But yeah, my interest really is towards sort of philosophical theology. Thankfully, my church puts up with me sometimes, and then sometimes all I do is grin and say, I'm deciding how boring I want to be when I start talking.
You know, that's funny you'd say that, because my brother the other day, he always asked me, so how'd your sermon go? And I always say, well, at least I interested myself. Well, I have to say, Steve, we love you. I mean, you're just like one of the family now. And so we don't find you boring at all. And I like the fact that a smart person like you wants to hang out with me anyway. So it's a double blessing. And I'm really glad that you're part of our group.
Well, I will have to say the exact same back at you, and not that it's necessarily a, you know, mutual admiration club, but I have so appreciated Epiclesis, and I have so appreciated your teaching, your passion for the word, and your passion for what it means to live authentically the life of Christ as a community of believers. And the dear friends that I have on from Thursday morning, and then the church as a whole, just through COVID particularly, we went through a lot heavier lockdown mm-hmm. here in Canada mm-hmm. than you guys did. And for 2 years, it was fairly tight lockdown, as in there were times I was preaching from my living room. So, it was those Thursday mornings that just nourished my soul. That's the only phrase I can think of when it comes to that. And so I value you all deeply.
Well, we love having you. Folks, you're listening to a conversation here in the Epiclesis Chapter House with Steve Pearson. Steve's our friend and buddy. He's a pastor way up in Canada, and he's coming all the way to Sacramento in the fall, in October, to talk about Lord of the Rings. Well, more than that. I'm sure we're going to hit on a lot more. But we do a fall retreat every year at a nearby Passionist Retreat Center. Wonderful place to be. And by the way, if you hear this interview and you're thinking, I'd like to go to that retreat, all you have to do is zip over to the Epiclesis website. That's EPICLESIS.org, and you can look for information there about the retreat. Steve, it's a huge topic, Tolkien and his world and Lord of the Rings and how that might interface with politics, because we do want somehow to work out politics and worldview and what's a Christian to do and how might Tolkien help. I was thinking before we got together today of a way that we might organize this conversation, and I'll bet you dollars to donuts, we'll have to do another one of these because I suspect we won't get to all of it today. But I'm thinking that the first thing I'd like for you to do in general terms is talk about your love affair, because you really have an affinity for Lord of the Rings, Tolkien in general, and so much more knowledgeable in depth, and particularly with your background in philosophy, than I could ever dream about being. Talk first generally about your interest in Tolkien, how you got interested in him. Then I think we'll talk about him and his world, sort of him as a person, his academic life, who his friends were, that kind of stuff. And then we'll get into Lord of the Rings in particular, and then perhaps, and it might be another conversation, flesh out some of the things that we want to be talking about at the retreat. So first of all, Tolkien. I mean, everybody probably, or many people, know the movies. A number of people have made it through those giant volumes and books. But how did you get interested in Tolkien and Lord of the Rings?
Well, I was trying to think about that today and trace back where my interest began, because I've enjoyed C.S. Lewis since I was a little boy and first read Chronicles of Narnia. And Lewis was a very dear friend of Tolkien for a good season of his life. But I never really delved into Tolkien. I think I read The Hobbit in high school just on my own, but didn't really grasp onto it. It was so much different than C.S. Lewis that it didn't connect really. And I had such a love affair with Lewis's writings that I didn't really plug in with Tolkien there. And then when the first movie came out in the early 2000s, I went to see it with a friend of mine, and we got done. And of course, the first movie, The Fellowship of the Ring, ends with Frodo looking at Sam saying, "I'm glad you're with me, Sam." Hmm. And you're only the first leg into this journey that is the Lord of the Rings. This is obviously a trilogy. And so the first one got done. I was like, I cannot wait another year to watch the second movie and figure out what happens. So I bought the book, read it, and was entirely drawn into this amazing world that Tolkien had created in Middle Earth. And that is when my love affair started, partly because I could see some of the themes that he was working with that ran deeper than just, hey, this is a really good fantasy type story. And so I have gone back and read the book a number of times since then, watched the movies probably far more than I should. Time in my life I won't get back, but they're just amazing movies. And each time I pick up little things that, yeah, you missed, you know, the last time you saw it, or you haven't seen before, just because he was such an incredible storyteller. So that's kind of how that part began for me.
Talk just briefly about his association with C.S. Lewis, because they were both very famously together at Oxford and hung out together a lot, and their lives are in some ways similar, I think.
Very much so, and they were drawn together by a couple of different things. One, they both loved philology, which is the study of language and languages. Not just, hey, I want to learn a new language, but how do language function, the history of languages. So if you gave me a word, if I was a philologist, then at that point you begin to say, okay, did that come from, you know, this century and the Latin in this century, or does that, you know, have a Greek origin or something like that? They both also enjoyed a lot of mythology and fantasy, both enjoyed Norse mythology and all of those stories that were tied into there. So those two things brought them together, their study of language. Now, they both were part of a group also known as the Inklings, which if you've studied C.S. Lewis at all, you know it was a group that met at a pub, that they would get together, talk over topics, kind of an intellectual discussion group, and they would also read each other different things that they were writing and working on. And so they would get together and Lewis would read from, for example, the Chronicles of Narnia. Now, very interestingly, Tolkien really did not like the Chronicles of Narnia.
He was not a fan, was he? Well, I understand that he was not a huge fan of allegory in general. And although he certainly was Christian, and there are Christian themes, so to speak, all through Tolkien's work, it wasn't nearly as fully baked, if I can use that word, in the allegories of Lewis. Am I on the right track?
Yes, Tolkien did really not like allegory, and he would call it shallow allegory or the shallowness of Lewis's writing. Now, Tolkien would write whole languages for whole races of people within his books. And, you know, you have The Lord of the Rings, which in itself is the three of them put together are these thick books. You have The Silmarillion, which was published later by his son, which is not as thick, but also it's a huge history of Middle Earth that he had written. For him, it was important that if a character was used or, you know, a word used or an idea or a certain way of writing was used, that it needed to be all located in the same time frame. And he would generally write pre-1000 AD in his mind. Mm-hmm. In fact, for him, Middle Earth was supposedly something that maybe existed, not in reality, but in his mind was something that existed pre-1000 AD. So sort of in that Middle Ages, well, not Middle Ages, but that what we call the Dark Ages back there in that time that you can almost summarize with one or two sentences in most history classes. But then he gets to Lewis, and he looks at Lewis, and C.S. Lewis has four children stumbling through a wardrobe, which Tolkien did not like any communication between his fantasy world and the real world. Those two needed to stay separate. Mm-hmm. Stumbling through a wardrobe, they meet a faun, which is so odd because then you have Father Christmas, which was from an entirely different strand of mythology.
Yes.
And an entirely different framework. You have Father Christmas and you have all sorts of animals and creatures that are just sort of pulled randomly from mythology and different types of writing. And obviously the allegory is very clear in Lewis with Aslan being Christ and the stone table, the cross, etc. Where Tolkien was doing something entirely different. It's not that he was smarter or Lewis was not as smart or anything. Both of them were absolutely brilliant. But they just wrote differently. And it actually caused some serious rifts in their relationship at times. Some serious tensions because just Tolkien couldn't wrap his head around what Lewis was trying to do.
We should talk about him a little bit as a person. He's born actually in a British protectorate, I guess is the right word, in South Africa. He considers himself English. I think he ends up growing up in Birmingham, if I'm not, you correct me if I'm not right about these things. That's my recollection. He and Lewis end up both teaching at Oxford. And one thing that, well, I can think of several things that probably had their impact upon Tolkien. Certainly his service in the war, World War I, has to have figured in there. He was also bitten in South Africa by a huge spider, which I always think of when I see that scene with our little merry friend who gets bitten in one of the books. But talk a little bit about the influences. He was certainly also a Christian. He was a Roman Catholic, as I understand it, and talk a little bit about the influences on him and what was his area of scholarship. You've already mentioned philology, his area of scholarship. What's he doing at Oxford? What were some of the influences on his writing?
Wow. Okay. That's a massive question. I'll touch on a couple things, and I don't know if they're going to be everything that you mentioned, so feel free to pursue and say, no, Steve, I want you to go this direction, and we'll go that direction. One of the things about Tolkien's early life was that he lost his father in 1896. So Tolkien was just a little boy at that point in time. I believe he was born in 1893. And he lost his father when he was 4 years old. Then he lost his mother in 1904. So when he was 12 years old. So early on, he had this journey of sort of losing both parents. But when he lost his father in South Africa, they go back to England. They live in this beautiful country place. It's not fancy or anything, but he lived in the country, lost his mother. He ends up going to, I believe, his Birmingham Oratory, meaning that he ends up more in an urban environment. And so you can see that throughout Lord of the Rings. In fact, and I don't remember the specific place it was that he lived when he came back and just lived there with his mother in this little country cottage. But his idealization of the life of the Hobbit is particularly traced back to that. And then what you see happening with the machines and the orcs and all of this, the sort of metal and grinding metal is mentioned in Lord of the Rings and these kind of things, industrialization, is what he felt like when he had to go to Birmingham. Mm. And you get more to the urban setting, which he despised and he did not like, and he thought fondly back to his earlier Hobbit life with his mother and the love of nature that he had there. He ends up, of course, at Oxford for a number of reasons, and in all honesty, philology was his love. He worked on dictionaries and all sorts of things. I was reading the other day, and I don't even remember, it's been a while, well, the other day's in a year or so ago. He had a word from Lord of the Rings that actually found its way into the Oxford Dictionary, I believe. simply because he became that famous towards the end of his life. They put in words from Lord of the Rings into the dictionary, and he was one working on the dictionary as well. So his love was that, and along with language, mythology, and that's what drew him to Lewis. And then, yeah, when he was teaching at Oxford, a lot of that was that those two would spend time together just in engaging that same topic. As far as his influences, one of the people that we're actually going to talk a little bit about, Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher who was a philologist, which once again, when I say that word, just think to yourself, study of words and language and languages and origins of language, that kind of thing. One of the guys that we don't have record that Tolkien ever read Nietzsche, but there does seem to be some overlap in their thoughts where Tolkien is responding to some of Nietzsche's writing. And so there's that influence that we'll work on a little bit and think about, but there's just, I don't know, a host of things and directions we could go with that. But ultimately, his Catholic faith, I think, was one of the most formative things in his life. His wife was reluctantly Catholic, I'll put it that way. I believe she was Church of England, but finally became active in the Catholic Church, active as in would bring casseroles and participate. But maybe that's a Baptist way of saying it, I don't know. But you can see the influence in the sense of within Catholic moral theology, there's this idea of the development of the virtues. And it's a lot more important because in Catholic theology, the development of the virtues is what allows you to have finally the beatific vision, and you're purged of all that is evil eventually, and you've developed these virtues, and the grace of God is infused in you to help you. It comes from Aquinas. And you make this journey. It's very much a journey metaphor of development of these. So in Lewis, who is Anglican, Church of England, and you get to the 39 articles right around 11 and 12, it's very reformed.
Yeah.
So in Lewis, you see a real focus on the moment of the cross, the moment on the stone table that changes everything. And then with Tolkien, you see the focus more on journey and development of characters, and there's not a one-to-one correlation. Like,
right.
There's no Christ figure. There's no specific, although there comes close to being one devil figure, but it's more of this idea of this journey, which reflects his Catholic moral theology.
And you could say, sorry to interrupt, but it just occurs to me that in some ways might be the best way to sum up Lord of the Rings. Yes, it's the story about a journey.
That's the way that I framed it in my mind, and it's far more of that than Lewis. I was thinking with Lewis, there were a couple of his books that have the idea of journey. You have The Silver Chair, you have The Horse and His Boy, but not nearly on the scale or character development of Lord of the Rings. And in all honesty, Lord of the Rings is a beautiful journey, and there are so many correlations to things we face in the Christian life and our own journey that I find it very encouraging and challenging from that perspective. Yes.
All right. Let me stop you right there and remind folks that they're listening to a conversation with Steve Pearson. Steve is a Lord of the Rings guy, And he's also a wonderful friend. He's coming to Sacramento in the fall to lead a retreat for Epiclesis. And we are going to be taking a look at the Lord of the Rings. But the title of the retreat is Lord of the Rings, Politics, and What's a Christian to Do? As I talked with you even a few months ago, Steve, about the desire for this retreat, we were both lamenting and talking and otherwise debating about how so many things in our world these days has become politicized. And some Christians, perhaps many Christians, struggle over where is the politics of the kingdom versus the politics of the world? And how do we get some clarity on what our role is in a very fast changing, well, journey that we're undergoing? Mm. And so you're coming in the fall to do that. And Lord of the Rings, the three volumes of that by Tolkien, is ostensibly our topic. And before we get to some more of the influences and things we can trace out, let's just do a little bit of an overview, and let's pretend like somebody's listening who might not even have heard the title Lord of the Rings. I should tell you that a couple of people in our congregation, actually I think about three, have said, you know what, I'm familiar, I know about the movies, but I've never seen them and I've not read the books. So let's just do a basic primer here for a few minutes about the books, kind of what they're about, and give us a sort of a broad, very easygoing synopsis of tracing out the story, the journey. And go.
And go. All right, we're on an elevator. We're headed to the 20th floor. I got a couple of moments here. Here's how this works. So he wrote a lengthy book about one ring and a bunch of rings. And when we speak of rings, we mean like a gold ring, like a wedding band looking ring. And the idea is that in this mythical land, Middle Earth, there is an evil presence and an evil being. Sauron is its name. And Sauron made a bunch of rings and gave them out to the peoples of Middle Earth. And he made all of these rings, but he also secretly made one ring. And if you watch the movies, this is a lot of where I'm drawing this from because there's a much deeper history. But if you watch the movies, this is a summary of the movies. He made one ring that would sort of control the other rings, that would draw them to himself. So he would give these rings as gifts. But what the people didn't realize is, and the beings that got them, whether it was the elves or the dwarves, or the men, in taking these rings, they were actually starting to come under the power of this one being, this evil being, Sauron. And this one ring eventually gets lost from Sauron. Sauron has it in a big battle, an epic battle, with all the peoples of Middle-earth and Sauron and his armies. The ring gets lost, finds its way deep into the heart of Middle-earth, where it's found by a hobbit-type creature. Now, a hobbit, when you think of them, think of somebody who's maybe 3 feet tall, something like that, 2 or 3 feet tall, big fuzzy feet, loves to just sort of stay to themselves in rural areas, very agrarian.
Good loves food, their, good drink,
loves their
family,
beer,
yeah.
Loves their pipe, and just will let the rest of the world do their thing, we'll do our thing, and we'll just go about it that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, this hobbit comes in possession of this one ring that rules all the other rings. And that's what the Hobbit movies are about. So what happens is then he goes back with possession of this ring. Well, this ring has the power to make you invisible. But also this ring has a power in and of itself. It's always drawn back to its maker, Sauron. So he has this ring. Well, over many, many years, it gives long life to him, and he keeps it as his treasure. There comes a point where Gandalf, one of the main characters, he's an old wizard in the story, Gandalf realizes that for Sauron to finally be defeated, the ring itself must be destroyed. Back in the mountain it was made, we call it a volcano, in the heart of the land where Sauron lives. So Gandalf comes to, well, I skipped a little bit, but all in all,
okay.
The ring, I'm trying to patch this together. As
no,
we
you're,
go here,
you're
Patrick.
Doing great, by the way.
So anyway, Bilbo is the hobbit that has this ring in storage. Well, he eventually decides that it's time to give it up. He's going to go live with the elves. And as we would phrase it, he knows his death is near. And so he wills his home and everything to his nephew, Frodo. And Frodo,
who is a hobbit,
is another hobbit. He takes control of the home, and with that, he gets the ring. Well, Gandalf realizes this ring needs to be destroyed, and that Sauron is really cranking up his efforts to find the ring so he can control everybody in Middle-earth and turn it into a nasty wasteland of industrialization and crush everybody, and freedom is taken away, and all things good and wonderful and laughter, and everything becomes one big fast food place. But anyway, so he okay, that last part I'm throwing in for entertainment. So
I love it.
Gandalf comes to Frodo and says, Frodo, we're going to have to figure out what to do with the ring. I need you to take it to where the elves live. They have a lot of wisdom. We'll figure out where to go from there with it. There's a big council where the elves live eventually, where dwarves and elves and men and rangers and all these different sort of people comes together, the good ones at least, and they have this discussion, this council. And it's just finally decided that there'll be this group of nine that will take the ring to Mordor, which is where Sauron lives, and destroy it in this volcano. And then that begins the epic part of the journey. And the whole thing is, how does that ring get to Mordor in the hands of, and it ends up being in the hands of Frodo, in the hands of the weakest of that council, a small hobbit. When you there you have warriors and you have seasoned fighters and armies represented, nations represented, and it finally comes down to this little hobbit is going to have to sneak into this country, up this mountain, and destroy it. And the whole saga is how he ends up destroying this ring, which crushes Sauron, the evil one, for good. And good wins, evil loses, and there are wonderful things that happen then, but things look very dark for a while. Yeah. In the process, you see everyone's character come forward and be displayed and grow, or be displayed and for what it is, in a not good way.
And once again, the sort of point, well, there are several, I'm sure, but one of the big points is that this is all a journey, and there are lots of things that happen on this journey. So just to sum up, there is this mythical land called Middle Earth, and it's made up of a lot of different parts, a lot of different people and kinds of people and creatures. And we've got this ring that is both incredibly attractive and has some wonderful aspects to it, but also quite cursed in some ways, that has to be returned to the place where it was made, Mount Mordor. And we're just going to walk in, aren't we, and toss it in there, and that's all there is to it.
Well, the movie would have been about 20 minutes otherwise.
No, I was expecting you to say, one does not just walk.
Yes. There's this great line in the movie, what you're referring to, the great line where somebody says, you know, one does not just walk into Mordor. It's a land with razor sharp rocks. And, you know, and there's this eye, the eye of Sauron that does not sleep, and all of these things. There's wonderful lines in the whole thing, but Tolkien is offering so many comments, things like comments on power and what evil does to people, what power does to people. Because when you grip the ring, there are only about one, perhaps two people, and I keep using the word people loosely there, but that are not affected by the ring. One is somebody that only shows up in the books and not the movie, Tom Bombadil, an interesting character, but he holds the ring, laughs at it, tosses it up and down, doesn't affect him. The other one is Sam, and there's one point where it maybe looks like it affects him a little bit, but not really. He carries the ring for a short time. But everyone else that holds on to the ring, it ultimately begins to affect them. They begin to view it as their possession to be defended at all costs, and they grip it hard. And in the case of Gollum, another creature that's had the ring for 500 years or so, the ring changes his appearance. He goes from this wonderful-looking hobbit, this nice hobbit-looking guy, to this twisted, mangy creature. The ring simply distorts him. Now, I've always looked at a wonderful visual illustration of what evil does to us.
Sure, and I'd like to talk about that for half a second. But let me remind folks they're listening to Steve Pearson. He's coming in the fall to do a wonderful retreat for us, ostensibly about the Lord of the Rings series, but also we're going to get into, my goodness, character and evil and what's worth going to war for politics. A lot of wonderful things are going to be in there. You were talking about C.S. Lewis earlier, and one of the things in The Lord of the Rings reminds me of something that C.S. Lewis talks about, even though, of course, C.S. Lewis did not write Lord of the Rings. C.S. Lewis says that each day, with each passing day, and I'm paraphrasing, we creatures of the Creator have 1,000,000 decisions to make, whether we will become more like the Creator or more like the creature. And that, to me, is Schmeagol and Gollum's journey, as it were. He continues to go inward and more into himself and what he wants and his preciouses, etc. And it ends up, as you just said, it ends up changing even the way he looks, and not only the way he thinks, but the way he looks. So there's a wonderful thing that we can look at in Lord of the Rings, where having the keys to, or at least access to, incredible power can really do some horrible things.
So Lewis was very much influenced by Aristotle, and both Aristotle and Plato, but particularly in his understanding of character, he leaned a lot on Aristotle, which a very grand simplification. But for Aristotle, plot is character, meaning forget the inside of men's minds and, you know, analysis of character that way. Their actions, look at their actions, because every day their actions will tell you character. And that is character.
Yeah.
Are you the sort of person that does, you know, moral action X? Well, forget trying to examine all your motives, anything like that. Just look, do you do X? Because that's your character. I am the sort of person that does X. Mm. And so he looked at it very much that way. And that's why, in some senses, with Lewis, he came down with that idea of 1,000 decisions daily form your character. It becomes who you are. I am the sort of person that does moral action X in given situation Y. Tolkien was very similar in that he looks at all of these characters, and their actions are what tell us about their character. Plot is character. And then we see, as their character is played out in the story, we see the physical effects of it.
Yeah.
And it's particularly evident, like in Gollum, because it makes him into, I'm trying to think of how you would phrase him. Okay, so here's the best I can do. If you've not seen the movies, think of a very large version of a hairless cat, almost. And he goes from being this nice-looking hobbit to this twisted, slimy, weird character. Like, visually, it has twisted him. And that is what evil does to us spiritually. We can still go about looking like our nice, cleaned-up selves and, you know, we look good. But our 1,000 decisions each day can twist us to the point where spiritually we might not even recognize ourselves. Mm. And over time, you know, and both of us have known older people that have made decisions throughout their life where it turns them either into a wonderfully beautiful person as they age. I think of how you described your parents, wonderfully beautiful people. Or we've also known the sorts of people that have 1,000 decisions of stinginess and bitterness and anger and holding on to grudges. And by the time they get to be 80 or 85, physically, literally, it's taken its toll on them. You can see it.
Yeah.
So, and he brings that out in the book. And so power, this ring is one of power. People grip power. It's a huge commentary on that.
So I can already tell we're going to at least have one more, maybe two installments of our conversation. It's been a lot of fun. We've already been talking 40 minutes, if you can believe it. But in the remaining moments of this conversation, let's do this. Let's once again recap sort of what the story is about, that is to say, the three volumes. And then let's start to sketch out some of the themes, the broader themes that we want to talk about in our next conversation. And you can also throw out some stuff that you want to do in the retreat too, that I don't want to steal your thunder, but we can talk about those as well. For example, we just mentioned what greed can do to a person, inward and outward to some degree. So let me just do a quick recap. Folks, there is a wonderful world created by Tolkien. It's called Middle Earth. And there's all kinds of different creatures and people and lands and cultures and languages. Remember, he's a philologist. He loves language. He loves to break codes. By the way, Steve, did you know, I understand that he had been earmarked to be a code breaker during World War II. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember where I read that, but I believe I've come across that somewhere in one of his biographies.
So anyway, he loves language, and he very famously invented not only whole backstories for his characters, but also their complete languages, working languages for all of these characters that inhabit this wonderful, mysterious, fun, also dangerous world of Middle Earth. There is a ring, hence the title, Lord of the Rings, that has evil origins, and there is a good wizard, Gandalf, who, with the help of a wonderful band of folks, including some hobbits and others, they are the Fellowship of the Ring, have to return the ring to the place where it was first made, Mount Doom, in order to destroy it and therefore break the back of this evil one, Sauron, and his power is crushed. He's ended there. That's sort of the very quick, broad overview. I know that this must endlessly fascinate you as you think about it. What are some of the themes that we're going to be seeing in there? And we can sort of I'll write these down and we can talk about them and pull them out more later. But what are some of the themes that we can see traced in this wonderful story?
A couple of them that I find quite attractive and great places for spurring on reflection on the Christian life, and partly the Christian life as it engages the political discourse, a couple of them come to mind. First off, power. We've mentioned that a number of times. It's called the Ring of Power. It's very obvious Tolkien is really offering us some commentary on power. He had seen in his lifetime, living through two world wars, serving in one, and then in the second one being involved in a number of things, he had seen abuses of power to the nth degree, and what that did to Europe and indeed to the whole world. And so he was very cognizant of power corrupts. In fact, some have accused him of being a nihilist at points in just his pushback against blatant uses of power and authority.
All right, now hold on right there just a second. So he is going to have some commentary on power. And I would say not only the destructive nature of it, but he also doesn't shy away from talking about the appropriate use of it for good, right? Wouldn't you also say that?
Yeah, because in the books and in the movies, there are plenty of battles. There's lots of swashbuckling, plenty of swashing and plenty of buckling, where there's definite good guys. And there's the definite, very clear, this is the right thing to take up the sword, ride for death and glory, so to speak. In fact, there's one scene where that phrase is actually used, and you find yourself cheering for them and knowing they're in the right. And so it's not that they
may die. I mean, this is quite literally sometimes a hill that we must die on if we must, but it's a place where we can use power for good. Yeah.
Yes, there's not a complete deconstruction of power and condemning it to the dustbin of evil, meaning that any use of power is evil, partly because I think Tolkien knows that there will never be any situation where power is not involved.
Right.
You simply cannot have a world without some sorts of power. It's in the idea of domination, and is the power being used to cultivate life, or is it used to cultivate death? And those words, life and death, I mean those in a very broad sense. Life is in joy and laughter and love and the agrarian society and the agrarian kind of culture that he loved. And those kind of things, that was life. And the virtues of bravery and chivalry and sacrifice for those you love, that was life. Death was industrialization and hatred and darkness. And he's so good at talking about and painting pictures of the evil land as having a foul stench and sharp rocks and this haze, and you never see the sun and all of this. That was death to him. It was far bigger than just physical life ceasing. So power used to impose that was wrong and evil, and power used to protect the weak was good. But the interesting comment, Chris, and I'm going to steal my own thunder here, as I will land on this like a ton of bricks. The most powerful person in the whole saga ends up being a small hobbit, the one that can take it to Mordor,
right,
and endures so much. You see others that think they can handle the ring, think they can go ahead and fight the battle on their own. They fail. But it comes down to the fact that power is in weakness and sacrifice.
Beautiful. I'm going to cut you off there, and let's do one or two more. We said power. What's another meta theme that we want to pull out and talk about in our next installment?
Okay, so one of the themes that I really enjoy in Lord of the Rings, and this actually plays into some of the ideas about politics and Christians interacting with politics, is when you have this council where the elves live, it's called Rivendell. You have this council. What should we do with this ring? We've come into possession of it. None of us can handle it. What are we going to do with it? We got to get it to Mordor to destroy it. How are we going to do that? And there's this fellowship that's put together, these nine people that commit to this journey to destroy the ring and are bound to each other till death do they part. And they bring their skills, the famous line where, you know, you have my axe, you have my bow, you have my sword, where the different characters are saying these are my strengths and I commit them to service to this one mission. And within our political discourse, my understanding or my thoughts are drawn to this idea that as Christians, we are the fellowship of those who live by a different definition of power.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is exactly one of the things that I think Tolkien is aiming at, is this is a fellowship gathered around self-sacrifice to each other, not power over each other, but self-sacrifice for the good of the mission.
Ooh, beautifully said. In fact, that's so good, you need to say it again. Say it again.
It's this fellowship where they have self-sacrifice for the good of the mission.
Yeah.
And they're given this mission of destroying the ring, and each one knows it could cost him his life. In fact, each one at different points despairs of living. But they know this is the one thing we've committed to, and all of the virtues that we've cultivated in our life come to bear on this decision. And they interact with each other in a way where they protect each other and they love each other. And there's even one that betrays them for a moment, and but there's repentance in the end and there's struggle, but the mission is to destroy this ring. Now, if we frame this in terms of the church, Tolkien being Catholic had a very high ecclesiology, strong view of the Catholic Church. The questions then come, how do we live as a fellowship of those that have been redeemed with certain missions being given to us as a body of believers? What does that look like in a world where power is constantly abused, where constantly power of any sort is used as a means to an end, where the end justifies the means? So as long as the end is good, I can grab on and use any tool of power. And the church, the fellowship, says, no, there's a whole different way. The way of weakness is the final way of looking at this.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. And I'm going to cut you off there.
Okay.
We've mentioned power, and now we've mentioned fellowship. I'm going to ask you for one more, and then we'll wrap up this particular installment.
Okay, so one of the other directions that I've thought a lot about in regards to this, and this will be a bit of a side note, I'm not sure how much we'll explore, but I want people to keep this in mind. Flemming Rutledge, the wonderful writer, written so much, but she wrote a book, a commentary, basically a passage-by-passage commentary on Lord of the Rings. One of her main focuses is how sovereignty and freedom play out. So as believers, right now we're living in a world where things look somewhat bleak, whether you're in Canada, the U.S., or outer Thailand. I mean, things are looking bleak in our world. And the question as often comes to our mind, whether we like it or not, is what's going on? What is God doing? Where is he in all of this? Now, we know it by faith.
Sure.
But we face those bleak moments of, for death and glory, we're going to lose in the end. And as you watch the movies, Tolkien has this wonderful idea of eucatastrophe.
Say that again.
Eucatastrophe. Okay. Eucatastrophe.
Got it.
And he invented this idea, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. He invented this idea, not invented, he recognized it, he gave words to it, that God likes to act in this way where just when things look bleakest, he steps on the scene and things change for the good in a sudden moment. And I love it because that's where his mythology comes into play. In so much myth, there's times where hope is lost, and then the cavalry rides onto the scene, or a messenger is received and everybody knows that the tide has turned. Most importantly, the Christian myth, the Christian story, and I say myth very carefully there, it's true. Don't take me wrong here. It's true. But Tolkien would say, and Lewis both would say, this idea of this myth, this story, but Christianity is the myth that happens to be true. But in Christianity, when all seemed lost on Saturday, and Christ was in the tomb, and evil it seemed had won, and he had cried out, "Father, forgive them," and it was like, a lot of good that's going to do. You're now dead. In a brief moment on a Sunday morning, all of human history changed. And that is the touchstone for his idea of eucatastrophe. You see this played out over and over and over in the movies, more times almost than you can count. And so as we think politically, it's easy to give in to despair.
Sure.
It is so easy, and in our own life sometimes, to wrestle with where in the world is God in all this. I mean, I know I'm supposed to say he's working, and I believe it by faith, but also as we watch Lord of the Rings, to be encouraged that at the right moment, God bursts on the scene. It may not be the way we expect, but he breathes life into the situation. That's another one that we'll explore probably as well.
Really, really good. And I'm sure you're going to have other things we're going to want to talk about as well. But in this conversation, we've gotten to know you a little bit. We've talked in a brief way about Tolkien and his world, who he was. Kind of a elevator speech of what Lord of the Rings is all about. And then some themes we want to pull out. In our next edition, I want us to dig into these themes a little more. And it also occurred to me, Steve, that when I end up editing and posting these conversations, and I will do so on our website in a couple of different places, we're also going to want to put some resources for people. I've been scouring the interwebs looking for overviews and ways to get people's hands on this big, huge thing, especially if they've never seen the movies or read the books. So you be thinking about that too, and we'll add some of those resources along the way as well. Hey, I'm already looking forward to this retreat. Man, it's going to be really good.
I am really excited and nervous because I only have about a few pages basically written, and it's still a lot of different things flying around in my head, but thankfully, my church has granted me a sabbatical this summer, and I'm able to spend some time focusing on it. And I was outside this afternoon working on some things related to it, and I'm excited. And if folks are intrigued by this, I encourage you go out. First off, go out and just rent the movies. Well, I say that as in that's a throwback to the old Blockbuster days. Go online, stream the movies. There we go. And watch them. Jot down questions. You may have to rewatch now. Who was this character again? Who was that character again? You can pull up stuff online about that just gives quick character breakdowns. And watch the movies, enjoy them. And then if you're really intrigued, read the book. Dig in, read all three, and explore it that way.
I was talking to Pastor Ellen earlier today, and I think what we're going to suggest is that different folks in the church who want to host a watch party kind of let themselves be known and pick a date and then have a few people come to their home. And maybe in July, folks can watch the first in August, try to hit the second in September the 3rd, and then when you come see us in October, then people will at least have that under their belt. And by the way, you need not be nervous. If there are things to look at, handouts and snacks, we're going to be set regardless. So don't put a lot of pressure on yourself. We're easygoing, and we can't wait to have you.
I'm really looking forward to it, Pastor. Thanks for chatting this afternoon. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and there's been a couple places I've also been piqued in my own thinking as we've dialogued back and forth, and I'll probably spend the rest of the evening chasing down some answers to some questions I have
sorry.
Now.
Sorry, I feel sorry. Sorry. One important question, though. You said you had a rabbit at your house.
Yes, yes.
And I know that Samwise loves rabbit and taters. Has your rabbit ever been in danger of being consumed?
You know, Pastor, one of the things I appreciate in my own life personally is staying in a good relationship with my wife. The lovely female that God has entrusted to me. And in pursuit of that, I say nothing regarding rabbits that is negative. I sing their praises regularly.
especially with taters. Steve Pearson, I'm grateful for you, friend. Thank you so much. Folks, you've been listening to the first and what will at least be two and maybe more installments about Lord of the Rings and Steve Pearson's interest therein and his coming to lead us in a wonderful retreat in the fall. Steve, bless you and thank you.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much, Pastor.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. And the Lord be with you.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. If you would like to learn more about ancient future faith or worship at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.